Excuse me. Om Sahana Vavatu, Sahanao Bhunaktu, Sahavidyan Karavavahai, Tejasvinavati Tamastu Mavitvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Yanam Namaskritya Naram Chaiva Narottamam. Devim Sarasvatim Chaiva Tato Jayamudirayet. Good. Welcome back. We continue our study of the Sanat Sujatiya, this very important section which is often excerpted from the Mahabharata for independent study. In this section, we're seeing this dialogue between Dhritarashtra and the Rishi Sanat Sujata. And just to very quickly recount what we saw in the last class, Dhritarashtra, looks like Dhritarashtra has a problem with Brahmins, because he complains to Sanat Sujata, why do these Brahmins go on? And he uses the term incessant prattle to refer to their chanting of Vedic mantras. And he asks Sanat Sujata, he says, by all that chanting, are their papas removed? Are their bad karmas erased, as it were, through this practice? And Sanat Sujata, understanding the doctrine of karma properly, says no. And we had a discussion about how prayaschitta is not a karmic eraser. We had that discussion in the last class. I won't recount it here today. By the way, if you miss a class, you know, you can go to our website and listen to the lectures, except not today. The website is, they're almost ready. We've had a problem, and I think the website should be back up maybe later today, but soon. Anyway. Sorry for the inconvenience. So Dhritarashtra asks, whether will the chanting of these brahmanas free them of their past papa karmas? And the answer is no. And then Dhritarashtra says, then why do they go on chanting and chanting and chanting? Sanat Sujata explains that eventually they'll be blessed by their sadhana, by their tapas. It is a form of tapas. Eventually that tapas will bear fruits, perhaps in some future life. We had an interesting discussion in the end of the last class between a discussion of sakama karma and nishkama karma. Again, I won't return to that. You can listen to the past lecture. So these brahmanas are driven by sakama karma. They want to go to heaven, they want a better rebirth, etc. They're not necessarily engaged in the life of spiritual growth. To do a spiritual practice without desire, nishkama karma, is for the sake of your internal spiritual growth, but generally the orientation of these brahmanas is for the sake of heaven. So that being said, Sanat Sujata has to explain how their practice of chanting will benefit them in the next life. And let's be very clear, the mere chanting of Vedas is not going to be of any benefit. You know, they make a joke that there's a Gurukula where the guru is teaching the Vedas to the students. The guru recites once, and the students recite each line twice. So the guru recites, Om Sahasrishir Shah Purushaha. The students repeat twice. Om Sahasrishir Shah Purushaha. Om Sahasrishir Shah Purushaha. Like that, they learn the entire Vedas. Well, it turns out that right next to the Gurukulam in a tree was some kind of parrot. And sure enough, what was the parrot doing? Whatever, I don't know. However a parrot would do it. So So does the parrot get any benefit from that tapas? And Senator Sujata is going to make it exceedingly clear that if the brahmanas are merely engaged in rote recitation, it's useless. He's going to give, in the next couple of verses, some conditions for those brahmanas who are chanting, for anyone who's chanting. We'll see what those conditions are. Let's pick up the thread. Sanat Sujata Uvacha, Sanat Sujata. And we have the longer meter here. Krodha Kamo Loba Moha Vivitsa. Krodha Kamo Loba Moha Vivitsa. Akripa suya mana shokau sprahacha. Akripa suya mana shokau sprahacha. Hirsha jugupsa cha manusha dosha. Hirsha jugupsa cha manusha. Vajya sada dvada shaite narena. Vajya sada dvada shaite. In the last line, narena, by a person, dvadasha ete, these what? Dvadasha, 12 problems by a person, dvadasha ete, these 12 problems, sada varjaha, are always to be avoided. So he's going to list 12 different problems, doshas, he's going to call them, defects, problems, that should always be avoided, narena, by a person, but the context is chanting the Vedas. So by a person who is chanting the Vedas, these 12 should always be avoided. What should be avoided? What a list! 12, krodha, anger, kamaha, desire, lobha, greed, moha, confusion, delusion, vivitsa is acquisitiveness, akripa, absence of compassion, asuya, jealousy, mana, pride, shoka, sadness, depression, spruha, you can translate it as lust, some kind of infatuation, there's a nice translation. Irsha, envy, jugupsa, disgust. That's a pretty long list. You know, you're used to the shad ari, the list of six, kama, krodha, lobha, etc. So here you get an expanded version. So you have a list of six, you have a list of 12. If we wanted to, we could compose a list of 100 or more, it wouldn't be hard, to identify those problems in our minds and hearts which impede our spiritual growth. And that's the context. The context is spiritual growth. All of these impede spiritual growth. So I'll just quickly go over the list once again. As I do, please reflect on if any of these affect you. Any? So again, do you have occasionally a problem with krodha, anger, kama, desire, lobha, greed, moha, confusion, vivitsa, acquisitiveness, akripa, absence of sensitivity, compassion? Asuya means in general, feeling negative about someone is asuya. Mana, pride, shoka, depression, spruha, infatuation, irsha, envy, jugupsa, disgust. All of us are subject to being affected by all 12 of these. And what is the point that Sanat Sujata is making? Is that this Vedic recitation will bless you by taking you to heaven. This is a specific context of the question. Those brahmanas who are chanting the Vedas might be able to get to heaven, but only if they are free from all 12 of these problems. which means her Vedic recitation will definitely bear fruit, but only under some restricted circumstances. They have to be exceedingly pure-hearted in order for that sadhana to bear complete, to bear its complete fruits. So he gives first these 12, ete dvadasha, these 12, sada varjaha, are always to be avoided. They must be removed. Only someone, a brahmana who is so pure-hearted as to be free from all 12. Now, the context is brahmana. We're going to broaden it up in just a moment. But for right now, we'll just talk about brahmana. So these brahmanas, because that's the context. The Dhritarashtra is, I suppose, he's sitting in his palace, and down the hall are a bunch of brahmanas in the prayer room who are going on chanting and chanting and chanting. And I could even imagine him being mildly irritated by that. Remember, he's sleepless on this particular occasion. Vidura goes and helps him with his sleeplessness. Vidura summons Sanat Sujata. So I could imagine King Dhritarashtra in his sleeplessness cursing those brahmanas for their incessant chanting. And here, Sanat Sujata is making very clear that chanting they're doing can bear fruit of going to heaven, etc., but only if they are exceedingly pure-hearted, if they are free from all 12 of these defects. I missed the one word, manusha doshaha. Dosha means defect. Dosha, is, I know some Tamilians will pronounce dosa as dosha. We're not talking about it, Ted. We're not talking about food. Here, dosha means defect. So manusha dosha, these are 12 defects that affect human beings. Remember that parrot in the tree isn't affected, but that parrot isn't going to be blessed anyway. Parrots don't have problems with krodha and kama, etc., but a parrot is still a parrot, not a human being. So these are manusha doshaha. These are defects that affect human beings that must be removed, because only one who is pure-hearted will receive the maximum blessings from Vedic recitation and other spiritual practices. And according to Sanat Sujata, no, not only do you have to be free from these 12 defects, but you have to possess 12 virtues, which we're going to see in the next verse. So this verse are 12 defects that you must avoid. Next verse are 12 virtues which you must have cultivated. What are those virtues? Dharmascha satyam chadamastapascha. Dharmascha satyam chadamastapascha. Amatsaryam hristitikshanasuya. Amatsaryam hristitikshanasuya. Yajnascha danam chadritishrutam cha. Yajnascha danam chadritish. Mahavrata dvadasha brahmanasya. Mahavrata dvadasha. Mahavrata dvadasha. So here, dvadasha, we have another set of 12. Dasha means 10. Dva means 2. 2 plus 10 is 12. So another set of 12, dvadasha, and these are called mahavrataha, the great vow. The great vow for the sake of purity of heart. Brahmanasya, for a brahmana, these are the 12 virtues that constitute what's called mahavrata, the great vow, a vow for the sake of pure-heartedness. What are those 12? Dharmaha, we talked about in our meditation session. Satyam, speaking truth. Dhammaha, self-control. Tapas, austerity. Amatsaryam, absence of jealousy. Hrihi, modesty. Titiksha, patience. anasuya, absence of feeling bad towards others, enmity towards others, absence of that. Yajna, performance of rituals. Dhanam, performance of charity. Dhritihi, firmness, courage. And shrutam, spiritual learning. So all 12 of these must be completely cultivated in a brahmana for that Vedic recitation to bear its full fruits. Well, again, look at this list. It's not an ordinary list. To always follow dharma, to always speak truth, to always dhamma, always be in control of yourself, always. Tapas, always be engaged in austerity. Amatsaryam, never having envy. Hrihi, always being humble. Titiksha, always being patient. Anasuya, never having negative feelings towards others. Yajna, daily rituals. Dana, charity. Dhriti, courage. Shutam, daily learning. Just like our list of 12 doshas was a pretty intimidating list of things to be avoided, this is a pretty intimidating list of virtues to be cultivated. And this he calls Mahavrata. This is the great vow brahmanasya for a brahmana. In fact, what he's done in these two verses is he's actually defined a brahmana. There's something a little subtle here. What he said before, several verses that we saw in the last class, he said, if a brahmana chants the Vedas, they can go to go to heaven in their next life. But now the question is, who is a brahmana? The parrot is not going to go to heaven by chanting these. Suppose there's someone who's father and mother were brahmanas, and the person goes on chanting the Vedas, but has many of these 12 defects and has few of these 12 virtues. What will happen to that person? He will not go to heaven. He will not reap the fruit of his tapas, his spiritual practice. Why? Technically speaking, he's not a brahmana. Now you're thinking, well, wait a minute. He's born to a Brahmin mother and father. Well, according to Sanat Sujata, you are a brahmana if you are free of these 12 defects and if you are blessed with these 12 virtues. So what he's defining is a brahmana in terms of guna qualities. This is an important topic. Many of you, I'm sure, have been engaged in conversations with other Hindus and perhaps with non-Hindus about the evil caste system in India. And we've commented before, no doubt the caste system has caused tremendous, terrible harm to people for hundreds and hundreds of years. Fact, an undisputable fact. But the question is where lies the problem? Is the problem with Hinduism or is the problem with individual Hindus? Right? So it turns out that nowhere in our scriptures is discrimination taught. It is never taught that you should discriminate against someone based on their caste. Now, nowhere is it taught. Further, these, and this is really our topic, and allow me, we could spend an hour talking about what is a caste system, how did it become such a terrible problem, etc., etc. I'll mention that in our teen class, we spend a lot of time on this, because the teens are real sensitive to this issue because they're growing up in a non-Hindu culture where they're likely to hear criticism from non-Hindus about the caste system. So it's crucial they should understand. This is not the time and place for that long discussion. But let's understand a traditional understanding of who is a brahmana, who is a kshatriya, who is a Vaishya, who is a Shudra, and I think it's, So the best place to find a definition, not surprisingly, is in the Bhagavad Gita. This is in the fourth chapter where Sri Krishna says, and this verse is so absolutely clear, just all you need is the first half. Chatur Varanyam Maya Srishtam. Sri Krishna says, Chatur Varanyam, the four Varanas, the four castes, were Maya Srishtam, were created by me. Were created by me in what manner? So Sri Krishna says, I, as the creator of the universe, I created everything in the universe, including these four castes. And in what manner did he create them? Guna, karma, vibhagashaha. Vibhaga means division. So vibhagashaha, according to division, according to two kinds of divisions, divisions of guna and karma. Guna, qualities, karma, actions. So according to a person's gunas, qualities, and according to a person's karma, action, they belong to one of four castes. Did he mention anything here about jati? Your birth, parents, etc., lineage? There's absolutely no mention about a person's birth. This verse makes it so blatantly clear that a scriptural understanding of caste, as opposed to a social understanding. Social understanding is predominant. Social understanding of caste is what's given rise to the abuses and terrible problems. But let's be clear, that's due to a social understanding of these castes or varanas. Here, the religious or spiritual understanding, as made exceedingly clear in this verse from chapter 4 of the Bhagavad Gita, is that a person is a brahmana, kshatriya, etc., depending on two things, guna and karma. Is there a third called jati, birth? He doesn't say birth. Guna and karma. Which means, if you have the gunas of a brahmana, you are a brahmana. If you lack, guna means quality, virtues. If you lack the gunas of a brahmana, you are not a brahmana, regardless of your birth. So look at the prior verse. These are the gunas of a brahmana. If you have these 12 qualities, and if you don't have the prior 12 defects, if you're free of the 12 defects, if you possess these 12 qualities, then, and only then, you are a brahmana. So according to guna, similarly, kshatriya, actually in chapter 18, he also, actually, in chapter 18 is more about karma. Actually, let's talk about that. So, what determines your caste is both guna, your qualities, disposition, inner nature, however you want to call it, psychological nature, determines your caste, and also your karma. So, it turns out, in chapter 18, Sri Krishna comes back to this topic. Chapter 18, the final verse, chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, he summarizes a lot of things. And here he says, Brahmana Kshatriya Visham Shudranam Cha Parantapa, O Arjuna, for all the four castes, Karmani Pravibhaktani. Their karmas are Pravibhakta, individual. They, each one has individual karmas. So the prior verse we just saw is guna and karma determine a person's caste. So we just talked about guna from the Sanat Sujatiya. Now here in chapter 18, he's talking about karma. And the karma, swabhava prabhavaihi gunaihi, different pravibhaktani karmani, many different and distinctive behaviors which arise swabhava prabhavaihi gunaihi, according to our qualities. The point he's making here is if you are filled with the qualities of a brahmana, how are you likely to behave? Like a brahmana behaves. If, on the other hand, you have the qualities of a kshatriya, you're ready to fight, quick temper, etc., then you're likely to behave as a brahmana. Similarly for Vaishya and Shudra, here he talks about each one of the four castes. We'll just stay confined to brahmana. So this is the next verse in chapter 18, where he talks about the karmas of a brahmana. So we just saw in Sanat Sujatiya, we just saw the gunas of a brahmana. This verse in Bhagavad Gita, by the way, Bhagavad Gita is still the same Mahabharata, remember? So we're still in a Mahabharata. Sanat Sujatiya comes earlier in the Udyoga Parva, the fifth book, and his Bhagavad Gita comes a little bit later in the Bhishma Parva, so which is right around the corner. It's the next parva. So here, also in a Mahabharata, in chapter 18 of the Bhagavad Gita, look at the last line, Brahma Karma Swabhavajam. So he's going to define now what is Brahma Karma, what are the behaviors of a brahmana. The behavior of a brahmana is shamaha, being quiet, dhammaha, being self-controlled, tapas, being engaged in austerity, shausham, being pure, kshantihi, demonstrating patience, arjavam, straightforwardness, not saying one thing and doing something else, jnanam and vijnanam, being committed to knowledge and proper thinking, astikyam, having faith, having shraddha. He calls these brahma karma. So tying this in, what makes a person a brahmana is guna and karma. So if you possess the qualities, and let's go back to our text. If you possess these qualities, you are a brahmana. And indeed, in spiritual life, we are all meant to become brahmanas. Each and every one of us, regardless of your birth, etc., we must become brahmana. And it's possible, since being a brahmana is a matter of guna, your internal qualities, and karma, your behavior. Behavior, of course, is based on our inner qualities. So this is how we define, this is how Sanat Sujata defines a brahmana, this is how Sri Krishna defines a brahmana. So let's be very, very clear. And that is, from a scriptural standpoint, your caste is determined by your gunas and karmas, and not at all by your birth. No mention of birth here at all. All right, enough said. And finally, we are all meant to become brahmanas. So if you ever get engaged in a discussion about the problems of the caste system, it's crucial to make a distinction between the social perspective on caste and the scriptural perception of caste, which are far, far apart. The social conception of caste is by birth, and not by guna and karma. But the scriptural perspective on caste is entirely based on guna and karma. So, what is Sanat Sujata saying? That the mere fact, actually, let's see the next verse, because he's going to explain that. He summarizes now. So these are the verses from the Bhagavad Gita. And then here, we come back to our Sanat Sujatiya. And we're back to the short meter. Doshar he tar vimuktam tu. Doshar he tar vimuktam tu. Gunar he tay samanvitam. Gunar he tay saman. Etat samruddham apruddham. Etat samruddham aprud. Tapo bhavati kevalam tapokam. Etat samruddham. Api aruddham. All right. So he concludes, Sanat Sujata is concluding this explanation to Dhritarashtra, and he says that a person who is vimuktam, in the first line, a person who is freed, etaihi doshaihi, and breaking the words for you, a person who is freed, etaihi, etaihi becomes etaihi, a person who is freed from these, doshaihi, not lunchtime doshas, a person who is freed from these 12 defects that we saw in that prior verse, one who is freed from those 12 defects, and in the next line, gunaihi etaihi samanvitam, one who is endowed with samanvitam, endowed etaihi with these gunaihi qualities. So a person who is freed from the 12 defects and a person who is endowed with these 12 qualities, the person we've just defined as a guna karma brahmana, one who is a brahmana not based on birth, one who is a brahmana based on their gunas, qualities, and their behaviors. So that's who he's defining right now, is a guna karma brahmana, one who's a brahmana based on quality and behavior. And such a person, etat samruddham api uriddham tapo bhavati kevalam. This is actually restating Dhritarashtra's question. Dhritarashtra asks, they go on chanting and chanting, and then how will that lead them to heaven? Sujata's response is, if they are absolutely committed to their chanting and they are pure-hearted, then it becomes tapas. Now, absolutely committed, he used the term ruddham. If their chanting increases, then maybe they can get to heaven. And then Dhritarashtra said rather sarcastically, they're already... Already they are chanting so much, how can they chant even more? What does that mean? By chant, they're already chanting all day long. By chanting more, they're going to go to heaven. And that's what this expression means. Etat samruddham api ruddham. Api ruddham. Even though they're already chanting a lot, etat samruddham. This is how it becomes even more effective. What becomes more effective? Their recitation becomes more effective. How does their recitation become more effective? By being free from the 12 defects and by embodying the 12 qualities. In this way, tapas bhavati kevalam. In this way, their practice of chanting becomes tapas, becomes a spiritual practice which conduces to the fruits that they seek. The fruits that they seek are a better rebirth, going to heaven. But the point is that that particular result, getting to heaven or a better rebirth, will only come not through mere recitation. It'll come if they recite, if the one who recites is a guna karma brahmana, then that recitation will be fruitful. Which means, regardless of your birth, if you take up some Vedic recitation as a spiritual practice, it will bless you, regardless of your birth, if you are a brahmana by guna and karma. And with that, he concludes his answer to Dhritarashtra's question. And this verse actually has an extra line. We'll see the extra line. Yanmam prachasi rajendra. Yanmam prachasi rajendra. Kim bhuya shrotum itchasi. Kim bhuya shrotum itchasi. Rajendra, O great king, yat prachasi, that which you asked, mom, me, that which you asked me, that is what you've asked me. I've just told you the answer to what you asked me. Kim bhuyaha, what else, shrotum itchasi, what else do you want to hear, what else do you want to know? So he turns the page, so to speak. I've just concluded my description to you, answering your prior question. What else would you like to know? And Dhritarashtra definitely has more questions. After all, he can't sleep. Remember, this whole dialogue takes place in the middle of the night. He can't sleep. Remember, he summons Vidura, and then Vidura tells him some nice stories and teachings, and then Vidura finally summons Sanat Sujata, all of us, because Dhritarashtra can't sleep. And why can't he sleep? He knows his 100 sons are going to die on the battlefield. So he's sleepless. And his next question. Dhritarashuvacha, Dhritava, Akhyana Pancham Harvedar, Akhyana Pancham Harvedar, Bhuyashtam Katyate Janaha, Bhuyashtam Katyate. Tathaivanye Chaturvedas, Tathaivanye Chaturvedas, Trivedashatatapare, Trivedashatatapare. So, next question is about back to Brahmanas. So the Brahmanas are all chanting. He seems to be fixated on Brahmanas, at least at this point in the text. I'm just imagining. I don't think this is described in the Mahabharata, but in my mind is an image. So his room in the palace is here, and over in another part of the palace is the temple room where the Brahmanas are chanting, and maybe they're chanting all night. I don't know. But anyway, the blind king seems to be fixated on these Brahmanas and chanting, and these Brahmanas are chanting the Vedas. How many Vedas? This is his next question. And how many Vedas, you know, then is it the more Vedas you chant, the better off you are? This is in his head, and that's exactly what his question is. He says, in the second line, Janaha Katyate Bhuyashtam. Janaha, a person, Katyate, is said to be Bhuyashtam, best. A person is said to be best. If they akhyana panchamaihi vedaihi, if they have the Vedas, vedaihi, if they are chanting the Vedas, how many Vedas akhyana panchamaihi, panchama veda, panchama means fifth, right? Panchama veda, fifth. Swamiji, there are only four. Well, guess what we're studying? It's considered the Panchama Veda. That's correct. The Mahabharata, loosely speaking, it's not Veda. We know that very well. But in loose terms, it's often praised as the fifth Veda, the Mahabharata that we're studying. So, the first part of Dhritarashtra's question is there are some people who are chanting all five. All five means Rig, Yajur, Sama, and Atharva Vedas, along with the fifth being Mahabharata. So he says, there are some who are chanting all five, and Bhuyashtam Katyate, they are called best. On the other hand, he says, Tata Eva Anye, but there are others, Tata Eva, in a similar manner, who are Chatur Vedaha, who are chanting four Vedas, Rig, Yajur, Sama, Tarva. By the way, you might know someone called Chatur Vedi, which is a common North Indian name. So Chatur Vedi is a common North Indian name for a family a Brahmana family whose tradition was to study all four Vedas. That was the family tradition. And then further, Trivedaha Chatata Apare, but Apare, there are still others who are Trivedaha. They chant and study three Vedas. You might know someone named Trivedi. You might also know someone named Dvivedi. Dvivedaschaikavedascha, Dvivedaschaikave, Anrachaschatatapare, Anrachaschata, Tesham tu katama sasyat, Tesham tu katamas. Yamaham Veda Brahmanam, Yamaham Veda. So, Dvivedaha Cha, and there are also those who chant two Vedas and study two Vedas, Dvivedis. And finally, Eka Vedaha Cha, and there are those who study only one Veda. And then he adds one more. Anrichaha cha tata apare. Tata in the same way, apare, there are others who are unrichaha. The word rich is the undeclined form of rik. You're familiar with rik as in Rig Veda. Little 1 minute of grammar. So the word is the undeclined form of the word is rich. Rich refers to a verse from the Rig Veda. I shouldn't call it a verse, I should call it a mantra. A mantra from the Rig Veda is called rich. Here it comes in plural, richaha. Richaha is plural, the word is rich. When rich comes at the end of a... When rich is used in a sentence, rich becomes rik. So rich is the undeclined form. Grammatically, you're forbidden to use an undeclined form. So when rich is declined and used in a sentence, it becomes rik. And when rik is followed by the word Veda, rik becomes rig. So this is how it becomes. So the word is rich, which becomes Rik, which becomes Rig Veda. So here, Anrachaha, one who doesn't have any Vedic mantras, is Anrachaha, one who doesn't even chant the Rig Veda. So if you're going to chant any Veda, if you're going to chant one Veda, chances are it'll be the Rig Veda. So Anrachaha are those who chant no Vedas whatsoever. So what is he talking about? Six groups of people. Who are the six group of people? Those who chant all four Vedas along with the Mahabharata, group one. Those who chant the four Vedas, group two. Those who chant three Vedas, group three. Those who chant two Vedas. Those who chant one Veda. And those who chant no Vedas at all. So having identified all six of these groups, he says, Tesham tu, amongst those groups of people, Katamaha sasyat, Katamaha, which amongst them, Tesham tu, Katamaha, which amongst them, Yam aham Veda, whom I should consider sasyat brahmanam, which of them should I consider a brahmana? So who is this is the Dhritarashtra's thinking, who is the greatest brahmana? One who chants all five, one who chants four, three, two, one, or one who doesn't chant anything at all. What is it that makes a person a great brahmana? Of course, we've already said that what makes a person a brahmana is not mere recitation anyway. We just got done with that discussion. We're not going to return to it. We're going to come to a different definition of a brahmana. Now, the caste, to refer to a brahmana by caste, Sri Krishna made it very clear, guna and karma, and not jati. But now we're going to get a different definition of a brahmana from Sanat Sujata, a completely different definition of brahmana. And this is commonly quoted in, mostly in commentaries. They'll say, brahma janati iti brahmana. A brahmana is one, this unique definition. A brahmana is one who knows Brahman. How's that? That's very commonly quoted. A real brahmana, after all, if you're endowed with all those qualities and free from all those defects and given to scriptural study, you have an opportunity to become enlightened. And that's the, we'll say, the highest definition of brahmana. Is not merely one who has those 12 qualities and is free of those 12 defects, but one who has actually used the teachings of the Vedas for the sake of their spiritual growth, a usage of scripture yielding spiritual growth, culminating in enlightenment. Enlightenment is to know Brahman. So therefore the definition, brahma janati iti, brahmana, a true brahmana, the highest definition of a brahmana is one who actually knows Brahman. And this is a definition Sanat Sujata gives next. He builds it up. Sanat Sujata uvacha, Sanat Sujata uvacha, ekasya vedasya jnanad, ekasya vedasya jnanad. Vedaste bahavo bhavan, Vedaste bahavo, Satyasya ekasya rajendra, Satyasya ekasya, Satye kashchiravastitaha, Satye kashchiravastitaha. So this is very interesting, the way that it's developed here in the text. Look, in the second line, te vedaha, those Vedas, bahavaha abhavan, became many. The Vedas became many. And go up to the next sentence. Ekasya vedasya ajnanat. Ajnanat, because of the ignorance, ekasya vedasya, because of ignorance about the one Veda, the Vedas became many. This is a literal translation of the first two lines. Because of ignorance of the one Veda, ekasya vedasya, because of ignorance of the one Veda, Vedaha te, those Vedas, bahavaha abhavan, became many. Because of ignorance of the one Veda, the Vedas became many. What in the world is he talking about? Well, it's a little bit of a pun on the word Veda. Because the word Veda means our Vedic scriptures, Yajur, etc. But the word Veda also means knowledge. Right? You know that already. The word Veda is derived from the Sanskrit root vid, to know, from which vidya is derived. So vid becomes vidya, vid becomes Veda. So vidya is a feminine noun meaning knowledge, Veda is a masculine noun meaning knowledge, and Veda then also means this group of four scriptures. So he's making a deliberate pun on the word. Ekasya Vedasya, he's not talking about any one of the four Vedas, he's using Veda in a sense of knowledge. Eka Veda, the one knowledge. One knowledge? Knowledge of the one reality. The one reality because of which everything else exists. The underlying reality because of which the entire cosmos exists with its infinite number of planets and stars and creatures. the one reality because of which everything exists is Brahman. And here he is referring to Eka Veda, the one knowledge. The one knowledge means knowledge of that Brahman. Now we can, with that in mind, this pun on the word Veda, we can make sense out of this. So, due to ignorance of the one Veda means due to ignorance of Brahman. Because of that, the Vedas became many. Due to ignorance of that one Brahman, the Vedas became many. And there's actually a very profound principle hinted at in that statement. And here's the principle. The Vedas are huge and contain many different parts. And it's, when I say huge, you would spend, well, the traditional period of study for studying one Veda is 12 years. If you go to a Gurukulam, you want to study one Veda, the tradition is you study for 12 years. I make a joke out of this. So this, let me just share this. I tell this to the teenagers anyway. So here's a joke. If you study one Veda, you have to study for 12 years. Suppose you're born into a Dwiveda family. 24 years of study. You have to study two Vedas. Suppose you're born into a Trivedi family. It's like the worst possible event is to be born into a Chaturvedi family. 48 years of scriptural study to master. Anyway, that's a joke. Don't take it too seriously. So, but consider this. What did he say? Ekasya Vedasya Ajnanat. These four Vedas and the potential 48 years of study exists only because of ignorance of the one knowledge of Brahman. The implication, he doesn't say it, I'm saying it, the implication is if you know Brahman, you don't have to study the Vedas. 48 years you are spared of all of that effort if you know the one Brahman. Now, knowing the one Brahman means if you're enlightened. And it stands to reason, if the scriptures exist to make you enlightened, if you're already enlightened, then what is the purpose of those scriptures? This discussion came up in our Tuesday class, our Panchadashi class, where we noted that when one is enlightened, the scriptures are no longer useful. And we saw the story that comes in this novel by Somerset Maugham, who has the main character has gone up onto a mountain with all of his spiritual books. Say he's gone up to the mountain with all the Vedas. He sits on top of the mountain studying, and he gets enlightened. And he's still up there on the mountain, and the weather is getting colder and colder and colder. What does he do to stay warm? He starts burning the pages of his Vedas, which makes perfect sense because he's already become enlightened. There's no further purpose to be served through further study of those scriptures, but there is some purpose in burning the paper to stay warm. So this is the point of that story we saw in the Tuesday class. Here in this context, one who is enlightened has no need for the Vedas. Therefore, the Vedas are for whom? For those who are not yet enlightened. Maybe almost enlightened, but not quite. Referring to all of you. Most of you. Some of you might be enlightened. I don't know. You. I can't tell, but I'll give the benefit of the doubt. All right. Now, here's the underlying principle. Let me take a few minutes. It's such an important principle that's so often not recognized. why do we have this proliferation of scriptures and teachings? If, after all, what we're after is that Eka Veda, that one knowledge of one Brahma, and what does that knowledge look like? One of the Mahavakyas is Aham Brahmasmi. I am that Brahman. So in that simple expression, one of the four most commonly quoted Mahavakyas, Aham Brahmasmi, in that statement we find Eka Veda, the whole teaching. So one who knows Aham Brahmasmi need not study the Vedas, but when I say to know Aham Brahmasmi, it doesn't mean to know the statement. You already know the statement. It means to know Aham, I. To know yourself as being the reality because of which everything exists. That's what it means. To know that you are the reality because of which everything exists. So a person who has that knowledge need not study the Vedas, but he says, because of that truth being unrecognized, therefore we have the proliferation of the four Vedas, and further, the four Vedas have different parts. And here we have to, the principle I'm leading up to, it'll take me a few minutes, we'll finish this before the end of the class. The principle I'm leading up to is called Adhikari Bheda. Bheda means difference. Adhikari means qualified student, person. Adhikari Bheda is a principle that says, according to the difference, according to the particulars of an individual person, there are teachings for that individual person. Which is to say that the bulk of the Vedas are there to address all of our individual and different spiritual needs. Let me explain that more clearly. Each of us are different. Each of us have certain strengths and weaknesses. And according to our individual strengths and differences, let me say, according to our individual spiritual needs, there are different spiritual teachings taught. And this is so unique, because most religions have this one-size-fits-all strategy. Most the biblical traditions in particular, one-size-fits-all. The Hindu tradition is absolutely different in recognizing individual distinctions and offering different teachings for different individuals. Let me develop this for a moment, then I want to show it specifically in the context of the Vedas. But before we do that, look in the Hindu tradition how many different teachings there are, and teachings which don't even agree with each other. You know, there are the Sanatanis who say you should do daily puja. There are the Arya Samajis who say you should never do puja. You should do yajna. And so these are mutually opposed teachings, but there's no opposition. You know, anyone who really understands the Hindu tradition understands that these traditions aren't against each other. They understand that they're for different groups of people. There are people who like to do puja. And we have lots of scriptural support for those who like to do puja. There are some people who don't like the idea of a deity on an altar. There are some people who prefer the ancient tradition of using a sacred fire as a vehicle for their worship. And these are different groups of people. Yes, there's some overlap as well. That's fine. But let's understand then that certain teachings can be addressed to different groups of people. It's not uncommon in, remember when you were a student, you had you had different classes and books. You had an introductory level class, then you had an intermediate level class and an advanced level class. Well, the teachings in the advanced level class would not be suitable for beginners, and the teachings in the beginning level class would not be suitable for the advanced students, which is to say then that the teachings have to be tailored to the individual. That's the principle of adhikari bheda. There's bheda distinction amongst adhikari, amongst individual students according to their level of qualification. So according to the level of qualification of an individual student, there are different teachings, and sometimes very different teachings. This is a principle that applies throughout the Hindu tradition, and it's even found in the Vedas themselves. And let me just show that we'll conclude our class with this observation. The Vedas are not monolithic. Each of the four Vedas has internal divisions, internal parts, in fact, fourfold. Just as there are four Vedas, each of the four Vedas internally have four parts, four divisions. Many of you know this, but in case you don't, it's good to know. There's the first part of each Veda is called Samhita, which contains all the hymns. Like when we're chanting Om Sahasrashirsha Purushaha Sahasraksha Sahasrapat, so the, one of the hymns. Then there's another section, a separate section. Remember, you've all heard that the Vedas were compiled by Veda Vyasa. A compilation means put together. Put together suggests put together in parts, in chapters, so to speak. So we're identifying the four parts or four chapters, so to speak. The second part, called Brahmana, which here refers to rules about rituals in great detail. The rituals are described in the section called Brahmana. There's a third section called Aranyaka, which means forests, and suggests meditations that were meant to be done in the forests. So the third section contains meditation, and the fourth section is familiar to all of you, called Upanishad. Upanishad containing the purely spiritual teachings of the Vedas. Look how different these subject matters are. So for those Brahmanas who are going on chanting and chanting and chanting, what are they chanting? Samhita. That's right. And why are they doing that? They want to go to heaven. There are others who are studying the Brahmanas to learn how to do all these complicated rituals. There are others who ignore all of that. They go to the forest and meditate, their meditations being based on teachings of the Aranyaka. And then there are others who ignore all that stuff and focus purely on the spiritual teachings found at the end. By the way, found at the end of the Veda, Veda Anta, Vedanta. The Upanishads are literally compiled at the end of the Veda. That's why we call it Vedanta. So the point here is someone, the Brahmin priests form a different group of adhikaris. We have one part of the Vedas meant for them, another part of the Veda meant for priests who conduct rituals, other parts of the Veda for those who want to retire and meditate, other parts of the Vedas meant for those who want to devote themselves to a life of spiritual growth. Notice each of these parts address people with different spiritual needs. How different is this system from the common concept of most, especially Western religions, which really is one size fits all? That's the most common idea of religion outside of Hinduism and Buddhism, I suppose we can include. But here we see a religious and spiritual tradition that is highly sensitive to the fact that we each have different religious and spiritual needs, and we have a vast tradition and a vast compilation of scripture which address our individual needs. It's both a blessing and a curse. The blessing is very obvious. The downside is it makes it a little bit overwhelming. It's so vast. There are some people who just say, just tell me what to do. Don't bother me with all these details. Just tell me what to do. Well, for such a person, maybe this isn't the best tradition for them. That's okay. But I think you'll agree, most of us recognize our individual differences and individual needs. And we are blessed to have a tradition which has, the whole tradition is based on this principle of adhikari bheda, a tradition that recognizes our individual differences and then encourages us to find in that vast tradition, we're encouraged to find those specific scriptures and teachings which are of maximum benefit to us, and those teachings which are not so beneficial to us, we're actually free to set that aside. Unique. Being free to set something aside, being free to ignore something and embrace something else. This is a tremendous freedom in this tradition, all based on the principle of adhikari bheda. Okay, good place to stop. We'll come back to this verse in the next class. Some closing announcements quickly. Tomorrow, Sunday, we have our program for teens at 11 o'clock. Also at 11 o'clock is our Gita at Work study group. You're welcome to come. At 5 p.m. is mindful movement and meditation. At 6:15 p.m. is a question and answer session that I'll conduct, satsanga. The library will be open after class, and we'll conclude with our prayers. I'll also remember that we're celebrating Ram Navami a week from next Saturday, 2 weeks from today. Okay.